Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is Jay Bradshaw.
And this is another Marvel Monday episode. And today we're going to be talking about a few Marvel books that we've read recently. Full spoilers. So if you haven't had a chance to read these, we are going to be talking about them in depth. They're all from 2019. So, you know, if you haven't read them by now, I don't know when you are going to read them. So let's kick it off with Avengers No Road Home. This is the sequel to the Avengers No Surrender weekly event that took place in the actual Avengers book. This was that series did so well, and the weekly Avengers book or storyline did so well that they decided that they were going to do it again with the same creative team. But this time they did it kind of on its own standalone thing, so they could have an extra Avengers book out on the stand. So it's written by Mark Waid, Al Ewing, and Jim Zub. We have pencils by Paco Medina. Inks are by Juan Velasco. Colors by Jesus Arbatov, and letters by Corey Petit. So there's not a whole lot to say about what goes down in this book. It's very Hercules heavy in the beginning. He's sort of our POV character. And he's talking about or being shown him talking about fighting alongside his fellow gods, fighting a titanic serpent called Amphisbaena, I guess it is, Amphisbaena. And he's telling the story about it being a two-day battle, and they finally defeated him, and then the gods all sort of partied, as it were, a party that lasted 2 days as well. And it's kind of interesting. I sort of didn't see the point of it, because I guess it's just to show how crazy Hercules is. I really didn't get it, because he finishes telling the story and the cop's like, "Well, that's great, Mr. Hercules. I can't wait to tell my kids. But see, here's the thing. We're kind of in the middle of a situation here." And so apparently it's a hardware store where somebody's inside causing havoc, and I don't know what that has to do with Hercules telling a story of a two-day party, but he goes into the store, and lo and behold, the person, or I guess I shouldn't say person, but the being causing all the damage is Rocket Raccoon, who apparently they've never met before. Rocket sees him and says, "Back off, Beardo." And basically what's going on is he showed up there to get some parts. They all freaked out because he's a talking raccoon, and it was a big misunderstanding. But it's funny because he repeatedly gets called a dog by Hercules, by the cops. Hercules is like, are you some kind of militarized dog? Like, dog? I mean, he doesn't look anything like a dog, but whatever. The whole hardware store eventually collapses, and Hercules has Rocket outside, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do when all of a sudden the lights go out. And meanwhile, the whole story, like overarching story, is being narrated by somebody. We're getting these dialogue boxes in yellow and red, and we don't know who it is, but they do tell us that this is a story of darkness. And then we sort of flash back a little bit to just a few minutes earlier, Los Angeles, California. We see Scarlet Witch and Hawkeye. They're sitting in a diner talking and just kind of catching up on things. And sure enough, all of a sudden the lights go out, dark as dark can be. And we get that voice telling us again, "I want to hide from the darkness, to watch from afar, to let the story itself play out. But the Avengers taught me better than that." So you kind of wonder, okay, who could this be? So again, we flash back just a few minutes in the past. This time it's Spectrum, Monica Rambeau, and the Vision. And they're running some tests because during the battle that took place in Avengers No Surrender, Vision was damaged, and now he supposedly is dying, and they have the same situation happen to them. All of a sudden the lights go out, there's no sun, and obviously that's a big deal for the Vision, because he derives his power from the sun. Then the scene shifts to somewhere in New Mexico, and this time it's Bruce Banner. Lights go out on him, and as we know, this new incarnation of Bruce Banner, when it's nighttime, he becomes the Hulk, and we do see that transformation take place. But then something happens to him that's a little different from what's happened to everybody else. There's a portal that opens up, and he is confronted by Endwi Gast, Endwi Gast's daughter. Endwi Gast is the Grandmaster, who was part of the impetus in what happened with the Earth being stolen in the No Surrender storyline. And so his daughter, he had basically fooled the Avengers into thinking that she was this sort of long lost founding member of the Avengers that had been erased from her memory, named Voyager, and was part of his plans. And then eventually, as she herself said earlier, she was taught by the Avengers. She sees their selflessness. She sees that they're on the side of good. She betrays her own father and fights alongside the Avengers. Well, here she is gathering a bunch of Avengers to help her fight this menace that is causing all the darkness. So, you know, the Hulk being a really powerful hero on Earth, she's the one that he goes to recruit first. And Hulk even says, he's like, I remember you. Did you make the Nightfall? Was it the Elders of the Universe? She says, no, but I saw who did it. And what I need are heroes. And the being that I saw do it, it's the most frightening creature I've ever seen. And then she adds, almost. And the Hulk's like, oh, you silver-tongued devil, right? Like she's insinuating that the Hulk is the most frightening thing that she's ever seen. So we do see her go and recruit others. She goes and recruits Vision and Spectrum. And then she goes and recruits Nightwing, or Nightwing, Hawkeye. Can you tell I was reading Nightwing, right? Future State Nightwing right before we started recording. But Hawkeye and Scarlet Witch, and then she's actually not there. She's actually not there to recruit Hawkeye. She wants Scarlet Witch because Scarlet Witch is very powerful. Hawkeye just happens to be there. He's like, oh, don't you want me to tag along? And that could come with its own ramifications, because obviously Hawkeye is the one that killed the Hulk per Bruce Banner's request. But he did kill Bruce Banner, and Hawkeye and Bruce Banner have made peace with that, but the Hulk apparently hasn't. And he says as much to Hawkeye. And then they go to recruit Hercules, and obviously Rocket gets pulled in too. So apparently this is the team that is going to stop whoever this menace is. And when Voyager says, yeah, there has been an attack on your home of Mount Olympus, Hercules is like, well, you need to take me there now. She's like, hold on, we need to go recruit more people. He says, nay, you said every moment brings more calamity. Open the portal, you know, let's get there now and see if we can save anybody. So once they get there, it's too late. Like Mount Olympus is just ravaged, and Hercules is standing around with his jaw on the ground, basically, because he's not used to seeing this kind of destruction. I mean, these are gods, and they've been they've all been destroyed. And they do find one goddess, I guess you would say, left alive, and it's Athena, and Herc is asking her, you know, who did this? Give me some clue. And she says, the Queen of the Night. It was the Queen of the Night. And he says, you mean, no, don't ever say her name. You must never say her name. I guess like Beetlejuice, it summons her. And Herc tries to say, this is my fault. I should have been here defending. And no, you always claimed both the Earth and Olympus as your home. And obviously you didn't know this was going to happen. And Athena passes away there. And Scarlet Witch, maybe in poor judgment, says, because Hawkeye says, oh, Queen of the Night? And Scarlet Witch, yeah, well, in ancient Greek myth, the goddess of night was a woman named Nyx. So maybe that's who we're talking about. And Hercules agrees, says, yes, if my father's stories are true, she may well possess the power to have done this. But where is she now? Voyager, do you have any idea? And all of a sudden, Herc turns as he's saying no, and the darkness has come to them. There is Nyx. She has appeared, and she's literally like phasing her hand through Scarlet Witch's face with two of her fingers coming out of her eye holes. So, and she even says herself, your sister was right, son of Zeus. She should not have said my name. So it seems like Scarlet Witch, the reason she's being the one attacked is because she said Nyx's name. And Nyx, she doesn't look real menacing. She's pretty thin. Doesn't look particularly powerful, but I mean, that might not matter. She's very tall, though, and she has a very long neck. She's bluish color. She kind of reminds me of Shadowlass from the Legion of Superheroes a little bit. So overall, like I said, not a whole lot happens in this. It's a lot of setup. Just sort of being introduced to the heroes that are going to star in this story, I guess, and being introduced to the big bad. The art's done really well, though. The color work is interesting by Jesus Arbatov. It's sort of a little bit of a muted palette. Usually you think Avengers and some kind of big, broad, dimension hopping story. You're going to get a very superheroic feel with very primary colors, but instead it's all a little bit muted. And that might just be Arbatov trying to sort of portray the darkness that's fallen across everywhere. Because what we learned when Voyager's hopping around is that it's not just like the sun that has been plunged into darkness, but all planets, you know, all stars, they're all like, it's eternal night everywhere. And it just went, you know, in a, like a light switch, and it's dark everywhere. So it's not just Earth that's in trouble. So it'd also be interesting to see if we have any other aliens or alien races or cosmic beings sort of join the fight. I do think it's also cool. We do get a last page that gives us sort of a lineup. It says the assembly, and it tells us who the main characters are going to be. And so it's pretty much who I said: Hercules, Rocket Raccoon, Hawkeye, Scarlet Witch, Spectrum, Hulk, Vision, and Voyager. So a good start, but I don't. And this often happens when you have a series, some kind of a limited series, or something that just kind of hits. You know, it's kind of like lightning in a bottle, and they try to duplicate it. And often the second time around is just not as good. The No Surrender storyline was just great. And it kind of came out of nowhere and people weren't expecting it. And it was awesome. This No Road Home didn't have the same legs. It wasn't received as well. It didn't, you know, people weren't talking about it after. And you know, there weren't issues that were real valuable in the secondary market and things like that. So we'll see how the story plays out. Have you read this whole thing, Jay?
Yeah, I did. When it was coming out, I guess the reason I kind of liked it was they kept the number going. I guess after the series before this, they kept the legacy number, so it was actually 708 of Avengers. So if you're a collector and you're putting the number one in order, it falls right in place with the sequence. I guess that's why. But like I said, I think second time around was just like a little mini series within the actual Avengers series. People were kind of tired of it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I guess we'll see. I mean, I don't really have much else to say about it because, again, it's all set up. Although it was kind of nice to see Voyager again because I thought she was kind of an interesting character. Va-ne-gast, I guess, or Va-ne-gast. Yeah, I thought she was an interesting character. So it's nice to see her not wasted. But I haven't read this before, so I guess we'll see how it all plays out for me.
Oh, yeah. The little jokes in there were kind of funny, too. Rocket was trying to get a part from Vision, but he kind of phased him out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the humor, I mean, and that's something I'll give Mark Waid credit for that. He's usually pretty good at that kind of stuff. And yeah, the police calling Rocket a dog and even Hercules saying, what are you, some kind of militarized dog? Yeah, there were some funny moments. So. All right, let's move on to the next book. It's a re-entry part two. So this is the new or most recent Captain Marvel series, I should say, from Kelly Thompson. I remember reading the first issue and thinking, okay, I think Kelly Thompson can handle this. She's got a good grasp on who Carol Danvers is. And man, I'm telling you, by the time you get to the double digits, it's some of my favorite Captain Marvel stories ever. Like I think Kelly Thompson may be my favorite writer of Carol Danvers ever. That wasn't necessarily the case early on. Like it took me a while before I feel like she really kind of found her footing and it started feeling like, you know, she'd be the definitive Carol Danvers writer. And some of that might be my own bias. I like the idea of Carol Danvers as Miss Marvel, or, you know, even if they'd kept her with the binary powers, I would have been fine with that. I understand that she has the Kree pedigree, right? They've given her that. We saw that in the Margaret Stoll series, Life of Captain Marvel. You know, we discovered, and along with Carol, because even she herself didn't know this, that her mother was a Kree warrior back in the day who was kind of a spy on Earth. And so the whole reason that the explosion that Carol was caught in that initially gave her powers, the whole idea was, I mean, she's always been linked with Captain Marvel, being the Kree Captain Mar-Vell. The whole thing was, okay, the explosion went off and Captain Mar-Vell and Carol Danvers were both caught in it, and it somehow fused some of his DNA with her and gave her the power of the Kree. That was the supposed explanation. Now, in Life of Captain Marvel, we find out she had that Kree DNA all along, and the explosion of that Kree device, all it did was activate her already dormant Kree DNA. It was already there. So I thought that was a great retcon because it made total sense. It didn't throw out anything that had been done before like some retcons do. But I still don't see why she needs to be Captain Marvel. And I don't begrudge it because she's a woman or anything. It's just, I'm such a huge fan of Mar-Vell. I don't want anybody to be Captain Marvel except for him. And he's dead. And I don't think he should ever be brought back. He's like the one character that Marvel, him and Uncle Ben seem to be the only two untouchable. Everybody else has come back, even Gwen Stacy. And I hope it always stays that way. So I just wish that they had just left her as Miss Marvel. But again, that's just my own personal thing. I don't, you know, they have her as Captain Marvel, and if that's what they want to do, then, you know, that's fine or whatever. It's just, I kind of like the idea of him because I was such a fan of him being the only one to carry that moniker. So anyway, let's get on to the issue itself. We saw at the end of the first issue, like I said, she had come back to Earth and she was caring for her brother who'd been in a terrible accident and helping nurse him back to health along with her mother. And then her mother was eventually killed in that series by a Kree bounty hunter that had been looking for her for years and years. And so she dealt with that. She dealt with her brother almost dying and then having to nurse him back to health and the death of her mother, and also discovering that she herself had Kree DNA and was half Kree, half human. And so once all that is done, we see in issue one, she's back basically. She's like, goes to the Avengers and says, yes, I'm back on Earth. I'm not part of Alpha Flight out in space anymore. I'm back on Earth. I'm going to be part of the Avengers. I'm going to be here, you know, helping fight the good fight and what have you. So Tony Stark's like, okay, well, things have changed a little bit since the last time you were here. We have to be much more transparent in the day and age of social media and that sort of thing. Please let this reporter come and do a day in the life of Captain Marvel with you. And the reporter shows up while Carol is catching up with Jim Rhodes, who last she knew he had died in Civil War II. But you know, it's Marvel Comics, so nobody ever stays dead, and he's back. And they had been a couple. They had been romantically involved when he, you know, died and it broke her heart. Part of the reason she went to space, get away from all that. So now she's back. She's catching up with him. She's got all these different, you know, parts of her life she needs to put back together now that she's back on Earth. And in the midst of this, this catch up with James Rhodes, this reporter shows up that Tony had, assigned to do an interview with Carol and give the whole, you know, day in the life. When in the middle of their meal, the nuclear man attacks this guy from some like future alternate type dimension, or we're not even sure exactly how he has the power to do what he's doing. So reinforcements are called in by Rhodes, some other Avengers. And so this nuclear man flees and Carol flees after him. The rest of the Avengers try to flee after. They're all male and they're all thrown back by this barrier. So who was it, like Thor, Iron Man, Captain America? There was one other, I can't remember who it was, but there was one other. Anyway, they were all male. They all got thrown back. None of them were able to get through the portal. Carol was, however, able to get through the portal. And that's sort of where the first issue ends. So in this one, what we find out is, yeah, there is some sort of alternate timeline or something. I mean, it's not exactly clear because Carol does get through to the other side and she continues her fight with the nuclear man, and he eventually kind of runs off and she sort of lets him go so that she can make sure that that Ripley, the reporter, is safe. And what she finds out is actually there's a lot of other people there that she knows, like Jessica Drew is there and Echo is there. And the woman, the girl that she's supposed to mentor is there also, Hazmat. And what they find out is that time is going by at a different pace there than back in the regular New York, right? So there's this barrier up around Roosevelt Island. And for some reason, it, like I said, it's some sort of alternate timeline where time goes by faster or something. And Nuclear Man basically is the one who kind of rules there. So a lot of the other people, like Jessica, has been there, you know, a week. Some of the others have been there longer. And so they take Jessica around and they kind of show her, okay, so Nuclear Man and his minions, if his automatons or whatever you want to call them, are trying to kidnap women. We're keeping all the women down here and safe. All the men have disappeared, except for one who apparently escaped from Nuclear Man's Citadel, Som, who's kind of this tech guy and is giving him a bunch of information. So now that Carol's there, they feel a lot better about kind of the state that they're in. And they feel like instead of just playing defense, maybe now they can, you know, break into Nuclear Man's Citadel and sort of find out what's going on and, you know, hopefully get back to the, you know, regular normal reality. Cause again, not much time has gone by in regular reality, but in this alternate timeline or whatever it is that they're in, time goes by much quicker. So there's a battle, a pitched battle, and things sort of go their way when Carol is finally in trouble, or possibly in trouble, all of a sudden She-Hulk shows up. So again, apparently that barrier that's up allows women to pass through, but not men. But unfortunately, one of the other aspects of this timeline is people seem to be losing their powers or they're not at full strength. So She-Hulk comes in and she throws like one good punch. And then all of a sudden she transforms back into Jennifer Walters and she's like falling from the sky. And that's where the issue ends. So it's a little bit of a cliffhanger. I'm sure that Captain Marvel is going to break out of the chokehold that this, you know, automaton has her in and fly over and scoop up Jen Walters right before she hits the ground. Cause you know, superhero comics. So yeah, like I said, these early issues are okay. It gets much better later on, but they are valuable. There's value to them. Cause I think it's set up and it's showing us how much of a leader Carol can be. So I thought it was okay. I do think that the series gets a lot better after the second story arc when you start to get into the double digits. But yeah, for the first arc or so, I just wasn't sure how I felt about the series. So I'm going to be curious. I haven't read them since they, you know, first came out. So we'll see what my thoughts are on them. The other thing I'll say is, so the art is really, really good. A lot of dynamic action in this, and it's very fast paced. But I will also say, as far as like the look of Carol, I really prefer the short hair or her having the full mask with the mohawk as opposed to the long haired Carol. But again, personal preference. So is this a book that you were reading at the time, Jay?
Actually, yeah. I always collect Captain Marvel no matter what volume they're on, I guess. I do like Kelly Thompson because she did some of volume 2 and 3. She wrote some of that. She also did Captain Marvel and was it the Marvel Corps or Carol Corps?
Yeah,
she did that too. So I think by this point, she knows the character pretty well. So it's a little slow at first, but it ends up being a really good series down the road. The stories are they get better.
Yeah,
I was just appreciative of her writing skill because, like I said, she's been with the character for a while. So I think for her at this point, it just, you know, she knows it very well. She can tell the story well.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said, the recent stuff, like the, you know, once she hits around issue 10, like she's really firing on all cylinders. And it's really, really, really good book. So I don't know that I gave the creative team. So let me give that real fast. I did mention Kelly Thompson as a writer. Carmen Caniero is the artist. Tamara Bonvillain does the colors and Clayton Cowell on letters. And the colors and the art are really good in this book. Like I said, there's a lot of action and, you know, we were talking about kind of the future alternate timeline kind of thing. There's enough sort of dystopian feel to the colors that you definitely get a little bit of a Mad Max vibe. The one thing about it that I kind of wonder, I mean, they talk about Nuclear Man having like a citadel, like he has his own castle there. So yeah, that's something I'm still like, man, I don't care if time passes by faster. This is clearly not like the real Roosevelt, or not at least not the Roosevelt Island of the Marvel 616 universe, because as much as it looks like it, you have things like, you know, Nuclear Man having his own castle, and in New York, and that's just not the reality of it. So, and the other thing I wonder about, so in the current Captain Marvel, she's in an alternate timeline again. Like, is this going to become a thing where once a year she goes to some sort of alternate reality? It's kind of strange. I thought, like, I got like sense of deja vu when I was reading this, because I had forgot about this, how she goes to an alternate timeline. And I'm like, wait, she's in an alternate future timeline right now in the regular book, right? Like, am I remembering that wrong?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. So, all right, let's move on to the next title. What do we have up next? Oh, okay, here we go. Savage Sword of Conan, number one, The Cult of Koga Thun, part one, Shipwrecked. It's written by Jerry Dugan. Art is by Ron Garney. Colors by Richard Eisenov, and letters by Travis Lanham. And I will say these are the brightest colors I have seen on Ron Garney art in a long, long time. And I liked it. It gave, I mean, so much of Garney's art lately, since he's gone to this more rough style with the thick lines and the, you know, a lot of blacks and just a real heavy line, and his style's not as clean as it used to be. The tendency is for the colors to be real dark and saturated, like Matt Miller colored him when he did the Daredevil run for the Charles Soule run of Daredevil. This is much brighter, and I think this actually services Garney's art a little better with these bright colors. It shows a little more clarity, I think, and so I like the way it works. As far as the story itself, I mean, it's Jerry Dugan, it's Conan, so it's kind of what you expect. You know, there's a lot of Conan being angry and him beating the crap out of people. And it's set, you know, being that this is the first issue, there's a lot of foreshadowing and magic that foretells, you know, Conan having great treasure in his future, but also great tragedy. So it wasn't anything where I read it and I was blown away and I thought, oh, this is, you know, awesome. This is amazing. I read it and I felt like, well, yeah, it's a Conan story. So, I don't mean to like diminish it or, you know, be reductive when I talk about it, but I just say that because it's clear that Jerry Dugan knows his, you know, Robert E. Howard and is a fan of Conan, because this feels like an authentic Conan story. So I say all that to say this: if you like Conan, then you're going to like this. And if you don't like Conan, then you're not. It really is that simple. There's not, you know, a lot to the story. It's cool to see Conan, you know, on a pirate ship, and it's cool to see him kick the crap out of these pirates who have no idea, you know, what they're dealing with. And the foreshadowing is kind of interesting. Some of the things that are talked about, he gets a glimpse of this mysterious, beautiful adventurer that he's destined to meet. And he gets a glimpse of a new powerful enemy who half his face looks reptilian and half his face looks human and his whole face looks evil. So was it enough to bring me back for the second issue? Probably not. I mean, most of the time I say always give a series two issues to see, you know, if you're going to like it, but I'm not a big Conan guy. So, and this didn't have me thinking that we're going to, you know, trod any new ground here. I'm not saying it's not good. I think if you like Conan, you're going to love this. And if you don't like Conan like me, or you're indifferent about Conan, you'd probably just be like, okay, yeah, it's another Conan story. And it's well done. The art's great. Storytelling, color, like I already mentioned, all that's done really well. It's just, I don't have much interest in reading Conan. So had you read this before, Jay?
Well, Crumb, of course I have. Well, I like it because I'm a huge Conan fan. And one of my first books when I was a kid was Savage Sword of Conan number one, which was back in 74. I'm not that old, but I did get it. I really wanted it. It was like $40 when I was a kid. The reason I like this is because they brought the series back and it ended with the last number. So, you know, the last number was 236. This is 237. So oh, yeah. When I saw that, and I was like, awesome, they're continuing the storyline. So, you know, with the run of that series, they didn't start way over again. They just continue with the number series.
Did the last, I mean, does it continue the story? Like does two?
No, it's okay. Kind of a different little line. I mean, you gotta, it's Almost, but not quite. I guess, you know, if I can say, I got to look back again, but I'm not really too sure on top of my head. I got to look again, but I know that was the last number for sure.
Yeah, because
it was a magazine, so it was a little thicker. It's, you know, different.
Yeah. Yeah, different being in the comic. Because I was just wondering, because the story starts off, like I said, mentioned with the pirates. Conan starts off and he's like floating on this piece of you know, wreckage from a ship. And he's like eating shark raw, talking about how terrible it tastes. So I was just wondering if the last story in the previous Savage Sword of Conan from way back in the 70s or late 70s or early 80s was him, you know, being shipwrecked or something. That would have been.
Yeah, I was going to look it up. I just didn't get to it. I'm so sorry. I was going to do that tonight, but I just forgot to do it.
All good. I'm just curious if that's the case. So you dug it, and have you been keeping up? Or are you still current?
On I still collect this and the other Conan titles I have.
Right on. Yeah, I read the other one. It was Jason Aaron. And that one I hung around for a couple issues. I thought, oh, this is pretty good. And then after a couple issues, it's just like, man, I have so many books to read. And I, like I said, I'm just not a big fan. So, but yeah, I mean, take it from Jay. He is a Conan fan and loves it. So if you're a Conan fan, I think you definitely would be on board with this. It just didn't do much for me. So, all right, let's move on to the next book. It's Winter Soldier number 3, written by Kyle Higgins. Art is by Rod Rice. Letters are by Clayton Cowles. And so this is interesting. So the Winter Soldier story, as told by Kyle Higgins, is basically Bucky Barnes. He's living out in the Midwest, and he's trying to give people who are sort of in the position he was in a chance at a better life. And when I say position he was in, you know, when he had been brainwashed and he had kind of woken up to that fact and knew the things that he was doing when he was working for Russia or USSR, that they weren't the right things, that they were, it went against his nature, you know, whatever was in him that was heroic was sort of rebelling against that. And so he's kind of let it be known out there through the grapevine that if you're in trouble and you need a fresh start, that he will kind of come and rescue you and take you and set you up with a new identity. So we see in the first issue, this guy who's got this police officer who's gotten wrapped up in some shady dealings with other corrupt police officers is looking for a way out. Bucky's relocated Hydra agents and SHIELD double agents and all kinds of things. But what we don't know is who's behind the attempted assassination of Bucky. He was out meeting up with somebody that he had relocated who was having trouble adjusting when he got attacked by a kid named RJ, who was dressed in an old style, like World War II era Bucky costume, you know, the red and blue costume that Bucky wore when he was teamed up with Captain America. And then we learned in the second issue that this kid named RJ had been trained by somebody called Mr. Colt to be turned into a weapon and basically pointed at Bucky, but we don't know who Mr. Colt works for or why. And so in this issue, Bucky has dispatched of, or I should say Winter Soldier has dispatched of Mr. Colt, taken RJ under his wing because he sees so much of himself in who RJ is. And so this issue actually covers a long period of time, like a period, because it starts off and the fight has just happened. You know, Mr. Colt actually betrayed RJ and said, you know, this was your final test for you to go out and take out the Winter Soldier. You failed. So he actually shoots RJ through the shoulder to get at Winter Soldier, who's standing behind him, you know, and so they're both wounded. And when this story starts, RJ still has that wound. He's laying in bed. It just happened. But then weeks go by. RJ's talking to Doc Samson, who Bucky had reached out to come and talk to RJ and kind of get at his inner demons, so to speak. And then eventually they go out and RJ goes on a mission with Bucky when someone else calls and says, hey, I think I've been found out. There are people after me. But in the meantime, RJ had overheard a conversation with Doc Samson and Bucky about the fact that Bucky's still going through stuff. And at the end of the issue, after RJ acquits himself very well in saving the
kind of witness protection person that, that Bucky had gone to save, Spot shows up and there's a fight and Bucky loses his cybernetic arm, and RJ is able to help and kind of save the day. And Bucky's like real proud of him. Like, hey man, thanks for helping out. And RJ kind of turns on him and calls him a liar and says, look, here you are telling all these people that you've saved and relocated about how you're the savior and they're all going to start over somewhere with the new names and new identities. And it's going to be like a perfect life and you're the savior. And Bucky's like, I'm just trying to show people that they can be happier. Like I'm trying to be, I'm not saying anything's going to be perfect. And again, RJ's just like, hey man, I read your diary. I know that you're still having bad dreams. I know that you're still angry. I know that you haven't gotten over all the things that happened to you. You're telling people that they can move on, and you're telling people, hey, I can help you change and I can help you leave the past behind, and you can't even do it for yourself. So why should I listen to anything you say? You want me to trust you? You've been lying to me the whole time. And it's kind of a simplistic way to put it. He does have a point, but at the same time, Bucky's like, look, I think helping people is worthwhile. It makes me feel better. And I'm sorry if you thought I was promising you that this was going to be easy or was going to be a perfect life. I'm trying to make it easier for myself every day. And I'm trying to give other people that kind of that same, opportunity. You just do the best you can and, you hope it matters. And so it seems like they kind of come to an understanding whether or not RJ is going to be able to accept what Bucky's offering him is another story altogether. Because the fact of the matter is RJ is very young still, so he hasn't lived a lot in terms of life experience. But at the same time, the guy's, like 14, 15, and he's a trained killer and he's seen a lot. So he's in kind of a tough spot. And honestly, if anybody can be a mentor for somebody in that situation, it definitely would be Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, after everything that he went through. Not that I want to see, okay, Bucky was Cap's sidekick, so now RJ becomes Bucky's sidekick, and it's that generational thing of, passing it down. That, to me, that gets old real fast. So anyway, they head back to Bucky's house, and they're about to go inside and order some pizza when somebody shows up claiming to be RJ's father. So whether or not that's true or not, whether this is some sort of trap set up by Mr. Colt or his organization, it remains to be seen, because supposedly RJ's mother passed away when he was really young and he got put into foster care and then passed around in the foster system until one of the foster people basically sold RJ to Hydra. So it could be that that's who Mr. Colt works for. It hasn't been explicitly stated yet. But for all we know, this guy claiming to be RJ's dad could be a Hydra agent as well. So we get the to be continued, and I guess it'll play out. The story will play out more in subsequent issues. So I think this is either a 5 or 6 issue limited. And I remember when I heard about it, Kyle Higgins, Winter Soldier. Yeah, I'm in. I mean, I like Kyle. I'm a fan of his writing. And Rod Reese was an artist that he's worked with before. He was his colorist on, what was it? The Cal series. So, I was excited to see these two team up again. And I'm not a huge Winter Soldier guy. I haven't read a lot of the stories with Winter Soldier, but this to me is ringing true. I think Kyle's given him a good voice. And like I said, other than I really don't want to see that old kind of cliche of, Bucky was a kid sidekick, so now he's going to have a kid sidekick of his own. That's the only kind of little nitpick. And I'm not saying that's what's going to happen here, but it makes a lot of sense that Bucky would want to help RJ because he sees so much of himself. And I mean, the fact of the matter is when RJ shows up, he's wearing a Bucky costume. So of course Bucky can't help but see himself there. So it's a more grounded and down to earth Winter Soldier story, I think. Then again, I haven't read a lot of it, but I know especially the Ailish caught Winter Soldier Scissor was way out there traveling to other dimensions and crazy planets and whatever. This is much more grounded. And I mean, even to the point where they're not even fighting like superpowered people, it's really going up against and living in that world of spies and espionage and that kind of thing, which is, I think, what a lot of people identify Winter Soldier with, especially from the MCU. So definitely digging it. And like I said, I think it's 5 or 6 issues, miniseries. So You've probably read the whole thing, huh, Jay?
Oh yeah. Like I say the same thing with you. Every time I saw like a story of Winter Soldier, it seemed a little far fetched, and I just was hard to like the character, I guess, because you know he just kills his ass and okay, cool, that's pretty much it. There was no in depth, you know, what the character's about. This was actually pretty nice because it's him trying to get redemption, but trying to make sure people don't follow his same footsteps. You know, try to give him a second chance because, you know, he didn't have that opportunity. You know, so I guess it's kind of cool. And but yeah, I don't want him to have a sidekick. I was like, don't do that. No.
yeah. We've seen that story has been done to death. But yeah, I mean, we do get. I can't remember if it's in this. I think it's in the second issue where we see Bucky's is. It's mentioned here when he's talking to Doc Samson about how he's still trying to get over the anger and some of the things that he's struggling with and, you know, writing it down in a journal. In the second issue, we see when he's meditating that he gets some flashbacks of some of the things that he hasn't been able to remember from his past when he was an assassin for the KGB or USSR or whoever it was. So he's still struggling. There's still things that we don't know. And if that stuff gets fleshed out, then great. But yeah, you're right. I think these are the kind of stories, the more human stories that need to be told with this character. I think that's where he works best, as opposed to having, he doesn't work great in like cosmic stories or, you know, super, like if you were to put him in that Avengers No Road Home story that we were just talking about, it just doesn't work, you know, playing around with cosmic stuff and gods. And yeah, he's not that kind of character. I mean, it kind of works for Captain America a little bit. It's not the best story for Captain America, you know, either, but for Bucky, he's a character that needs to be, you know, more grounded, more street level. So I'm glad that Kyle Higgins, you know, understands that. All right, let's move on to Old Man Logan number 4. This one's written by Ed Brisson with art by Mike Henderson, colors by Nolan Woodard, and letters by Cordy Petit. We saw in issue 3 how Mysterio had fooled Logan into attacking a bunch of people in Times Square, thinking that they were villains, including the Avengers, thinking they were members of the Sinister Six. And the X-Men showed up and they convinced the Avengers to let them take Old Man Logan away and they would handle it internally. So we see in this issue that when it opens up, he's sort of in this nutrient bath, sort of like Luke in Empire Strikes Back, and he's getting treatment. And the X-Men's doctor, Cecilia, tells him, hey, you know, a few days ago, actually, when I told you you had a year to go, well, yeah, now you only have 6 months because you keep taking the Regenerex and you keep going out there and fighting and hurting yourself. Meanwhile, Hawkeye has gone back to his apartment, drinking some coffee when Mysterio himself shows up. And we did see Mysterio had discovered that Miss Sinister and Sin and Crossbones planned on killing him as soon as his usefulness came to an end. And so he managed to escape, and now he's actually out trying to get help from the very people that he was running from before, because he realizes, hey, Miss Sinister wasn't giving it to me straight. Yeah, Logan's out here trying to kill me, but they're going to kill me for sure as soon as my usefulness is done. So he goes to Hawkeye instead of to Logan, because in his own words, he's like, I came here to get help from you, because if I went to Hawkeye, he's likely to kill me first and, you know, ask questions later. So Hawkeye agrees to take Mysterio to talk to Logan, and then they're going to leave it up to Logan of what Logan wants to do with Mysterio. So meanwhile, the trio of villains, Miss Sinister, Crossbones, and Sin are mad that he escaped. They're trying to figure out where he might be, where Mysterio might have gotten to, so they can go back and get him and figure out, you know, what comes next. So meanwhile, when Logan wakes up, they're kind of confronting him about the fact that he has just cut his time in half again because he used the Regen-X again. And he's explaining, hey, I'm not going to apologize. I know I'm dying. It's been a long time coming. I had one tragedy that in my lifetime that I absolutely have to stop, and I'm basically willing to pay any price. And Silly's like, I'm not going to argue with you. There's no point. But, you know, like I said, you don't have 12 months anymore. You have 6 months. And every time you use that Regen-X, you're going to have it again. So I want to make sure you understand. And he says, yeah, Doc, I got it. So meanwhile, Hawkeye and Mysterio show up. And there's a funny bit with Mysterio trying to pick a good disguise to go in as, because obviously if Logan sees Mysterio, he may just, you know, stab first and ask questions later. So first he changes into Professor X, and Hawkeye's like, yeah, Professor X is dead. Okay, how about Cyclops? Also dead. How about Jean Grey? Oh God, no. How about Old Man Cable? No, he's dead too. Like, man, how do you even keep track? So eventually he settles on one, and then the scene cuts to the psychiatric hospital where Mysterio had been hanging out previous to Miss Sinister finding him, and they try to get some answers of where they might be, but it doesn't really work out too well, and they end up feeling like it's just a big waste of time. So meanwhile, when Mysterio walks in disguised as Jubilee, it doesn't really work out because Jubilee's already in the room. So clearly that wasn't the best choice of disguise, but Hawkeye managed to stop him, say, hey, listen, let him explain, hear him out. And so he sort of explains, hey, you know, same thing you told Hawkeye earlier. These guys tricked me. It's not anything I want to do. I want to be out of the life. I don't want to be a supervillain anymore. And they say, okay, well, tell us where these people are, and you know, we'll go and stop them. And so they head out over the Pacific Ocean. They're heading to the Neo Hydra base, and we see who's there, like Forge, Jubilee, Hawkeye, Glob, Mysterio, Old Man Logan, and they're talking about how they're hoping that this isn't a suicide mission. Mysterio's lamenting that he, like, why did I have to come? Like, I'm of no use to you. You know, I'm not a good fighter or whatever. And I love it. Logan says, it's because I brought you because I don't trust you. So I'm keeping you close. So if it looks like you lied to us at any point, and I love this line, he says, I can claw punch you in the brain pan and dump your body in the ocean for the sharks to eat. So it's clear that he's not messing around at all. He's going to punch Mysterio. He's going to claw punch him in the brain pan and feed him to the sharks if Mysterio is not telling the truth about this Neo Hydra. So the Blackbird shows up at the base, starts to land. A bunch of Hydra agents pull out their guns, start shooting at it, and that's where we get the to be continued. So action's definitely ramping up while Dead Man Logan's or Old Man Logan's time is growing shorter and shorter. So we'll see. I'm sort of curious. So, I mean, if he really is out to just stop the same thing from happening again, like, isn't it just as simple as killing Mysterio? Like, regardless of if Mysterio is trying to turn over a new leaf or not. So, you know, wouldn't he just kill him anyway? I mean, I don't think the X-Men are just going to let him kill him, but it's sort of interesting that he's sort of flipping on that idea, going, well, it was actually the other people, you know, Miss Sinister and Sin and Crossbones who wanted to use Mysterio's power against me. Maybe it's worth taking them out. So kind of interesting when we start talking about alternate timelines and possible futures, whatever. I mean, any number of things can happen. And so you kind of wonder, like, what's the point in the first place? He ought to just go through that time portal that Forge fixed for him and go back to his own time and kind of die in peace, is my feeling. But if he wants to use his last breath to kill Sin and Crossbones and Miss Sinister, you know, yeah, more power to you. You're not really going to kill him though, Logan, because Marvel Comics, nobody ever really dies. So any thoughts on this? Any thoughts on this one, Jay?
That was a good read. Like I said, I read the whole series. So this one just seemed like it was like, I guess, filler just to show that, hey, went to go talk to the X-Men to say, hey, I want to make peace. I want to fix this. But a lot of the jokes were pretty funny in there. Like you said, when he's trying to change and find the perfect character, you know. The whole idea of them going to the psych ward and killing everybody, which is what they did. It's like, that was pointless.
Yeah.
I didn't even know why they went there. It's like, these people were nuts. They're not going to have any kind of information whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I talked before when we talked about issue 3 about Ed Brisson. I kind of expect a little more from him. Not that this isn't a fun or entertaining series, and I'm sure he's doing it a little more tongue-in-cheek, trying to do something different than he's done before. Because usually his stuff, it's like, well, you're talking about real angst and real, you know, interpersonal dynamics and relationships between the characters. Whereas here, it's just, yeah, like you said, at one point, I'm like, man, they went in there and just killed all those psychiatric patients. They're just littered around. They're all dead. And that's a pretty high body count. And you're just supposed to be like, okay. Meanwhile, I turn the pages, we start making jokes. So you got to definitely take this one sort of tongue in cheek and not take it too seriously. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you have no choice but to take it that way, which is not, you know, like I said, normal for what I read in Ed Brisson's work. So, but yeah, I mean, I think the artwork from Mike Hawthorne works really well with the stories and the jokes and the tone that Brisson is going for. It's just so different from what his usual stuff is. So, all right, let's move on to the next book. It's Ironheart number 3. This one's written by Eve L. Ewing, art by Luciano Vecchio, layouts by Juffo, and colors by Matt Miller, with Clayton Cowles on letters. So we saw last issue that there's some sort of either evil person or leader or organization that's kind of taking kids that are homeless or runaways and taking them off the street and forcing them to steal for him, steal cell phones, steal data, all that kind of thing. And so Riri's trying to find out who's behind it, because one of her friends is missing, and they're worried that she's involved. Dijah is her name. So Riri's trying to figure it out while she's juggling supposedly being at MIT with the pressure her mother's putting on her, like, why aren't you in school? And Riri's like, I'm here. I'm trying to help my friend. I have my AI going to class for me. It's got this boy that she's hanging out with that has a crush on her. So it's all these different things, these different sort of stresses in Riri's life that are pulling her in different directions. And while they're all trying to figure out, all of a sudden Dijah just shows up at a hospital saying that she was stressed and she's feeling all of this anxiety. So she ran away from home and tripped on a branch in a wooded area outside the city, was knocked unconscious for days. And then, you know, now she's in the hospital, and Riri's not buying it at all. And so she goes to the hospital room to get some answers, and Dijah just blows her off, basically saying, I don't believe what you were saying was true. But Deja's like, you know, I think you're just here out of survivor's guilt. Like, you know, you made it out of the hood, and you know, you're grown up and you're better than all of us. And so you're trying to come back and help out because you feel guilty that you got out and so many of us are still here. Ruby's like, that's not it at all. But Dijah basically kicks her out. So Riri, again, she knows something's going on that's more than meets the eye. And so she actually left a bug behind in the room for Dijah. And when Riri leaves, there's a voice from the shadows that said, I knew this would happen. And Dijah says, you know, please don't hurt her. Leave her alone. She's not coming back. And this mysterious figure, whoever it is, says, look, I told you I'd let you go. And if Riri showed no interest in you, I'd let her go too, but you're wrong. Clearly she thinks something's going on and she's going to pay with her life. And so Riri has overheard all this. And so she starts tracking this guy, and we learn that he's some sort of ninja thief kind of person. It's not somebody that I've never heard of. I don't even know if this is his first appearance or he showed up before. His name is Midnight Fire. Or Midnight's Fire, master thief, expert martial artist, magical ability, superior agility, superior strength, extrasensory perception. And so he and Riri have somewhat of a fight. And during the fight, it seems like Riri's experiencing some PTSD symptoms where she's getting flashbacks to, you know, previous fights, and she's really having a tough time. And so she actually wins the fight and knocks the guy out and then calls the authorities. But she doesn't stay to make sure that this guy is captured. And she even tells her AI, okay, the cops are coming, Natalie, you know, let's go. And the AI is like calling her out on that, saying, look, you stormed out of the house looking for trouble with no plan. You almost lost this fight and died again. Like, you need some help, man. You're like flying off the handle here. And Riri's rejecting that, saying, I needed to figure out what was happening with Dijah. I need to act like a hero. I need to handle my business. I need to stop being ruled by fear. And it's clear that that is exactly what she's being ruled by. She's so worried about like failing or not living up to. And again, it's all these different stresses in her life, I think, are causing this. And the AI says, well, do you think your mother deserves to lose someone again because you're full of pride and you don't want to ask anybody for help? How many people have to die? And Riri hears that. She's like, nope, you're done. So she tells the AI to deactivate, and she says, I just need to be alone, you know, deactivate for 2 hours, run an update cycle and routine maintenance. And then she flies up to a high spot. She takes off her helmet and and she's crying. She's in tears. And clearly, again, there's all this stress that she's feeling from all these expectations that people are putting on her, least of all herself, right? She's got all these expectations for herself. She thinks she needs to be, you know, strong, and she needs to do it alone, and hasn't learned that life lesson. Again, she's a very young woman, and especially being a person of color, and you know, that adds even more stress when you are, you know, a person who came from nothing, came from the hood. Then you have the added pressure of being a role model, you know, more so than maybe somebody who, Caucasian. And so she's got all those stresses she puts on herself, plus the expectations of her mom, plus the expectations of, you know, the press and the, you know, the world at large, being that she's a hero. And it's clear that the stresses are getting to her. So the issue ends as the police show up at the warehouse, and obviously there's nobody there because Riri didn't hang around to make sure Midnight's fire got captured. So it's the strength of the narrative that Eve Ewing has been telling in the story from the beginning, all the superheroics, all the fights between the supervillains, all the time Riri spends in the armor doing amazing things. To me, that's all secondary to the story that Eve Ewing is telling about this young African-American woman who's sort of learning to come into her own. She has so many lessons to learn. She has so far to come because she's new at this. And I'm not saying she's new at being a superhero. I mean, she's new at being a young woman who needs to be in charge of her own agency and needs to learn one of the most important lessons of all, which is showing strength doesn't mean doing things alone. Showing strength means knowing when you can't do it alone, knowing when you do need to ask for help. So it's a big part, I think, of what Eve Ewing is building up to. We haven't gotten there yet, obviously. But I definitely enjoy this book, and I it's a great journey that that Eve Ewing is taking us on. The art by Luciano Vecchio is really great. It's really clean art. The colors by Matt Milla, very primary, which suits a book starring a young heroine, and a very traditionally superhero book. And it shows the strength of Matt Milla, because, you know, last thing I saw him on was that Charles Soule run of Daredevil, where everything was dark and red and black, and here we are with a lot of primary colors, a lot of pastels as well, because again, you know, female characters and even Ironheart's armor here is you know, it's not even the traditional red and gold, but more of a pink and gold. So definitely the color palette that Matt Milla has chosen here really works. Plus, I like the design of Midnight's Fire. I think that works really well also. So yeah, I think this is an underrated book. I know the series didn't last real long time, and I don't know if that was because of Eve Ewing not having the time to write it, or if the sales weren't that good, but I know it was good while it lasted. So was this a series that you picked up?
No, and I was gonna probably point out why I think it kind of didn't last long is because when it was coming out, collectors were told that this book was targeted toward younger readers, to like show how, you know, it's harder for them to be a kid and how to, you know, balance being a superhero. So I think some people just took it like being like Spider-Man when he first started out. He had to deal with school, being bullied, you know, being smart and all that kind of stuff. So I think I didn't pick it up because I was like, well, I was kind of turned off. I was like, I don't want to read that because I'm kind of older. I want to deal with the, you know, the other stuff. I don't want to start over with, you know, like a kiddie book. That's what, yeah, I kind of saw it as. But I was reading, I was like, it wasn't that bad. It was actually really put together really well. And you said the art was really great. And then only thing I didn't like is, why didn't she just stay to arrest this guy? Because at the very end of the panel, he got away. It's like, oh, don't do it. Don't be bad woman. Make sure you stick around and arrest him.
Yeah. I mean, we all saw that coming a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think I do remember hearing something about, yeah, thinking it was targeted toward, you know, young female readers, especially. And I honestly, I almost didn't read it either. I was like, well, you know, I'm just going to check out the first issue just to see. And right. I was very pleasantly surprised at how good the first issue was. I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. And I read the second one. I'm like, yeah. And I think by the third issue here, I'm like, I'm in. I think Eve Ewing is doing a great job with Riri. Cause I really didn't, you know, have, I was like, I don't want to read about anybody in the Iron Man armor except for Tony Stark at this point. You know, enough other people have done it, have worn the armor. I feel like been there, done that. Just give me Tony Stark as Iron Man. So when she took over, I was like, that's not something I want to read. So when I heard she's getting her own series, because Tony Stark was back, yeah, I was kind of put off on it too. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to check it out. But like, you know what? I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to read the first issue. It was good enough. It brought me back for the second one. And by the end of the second one, I'm like, yeah, this is good. I'm going to have to keep reading it. And I think this third issue, you really start to see the stresses and the effect that they're having on Riri. And you start to realize that, okay, this is a relatable book, no matter who you are, no matter what age, male, female, whatever, you know, we can all relate to being, you know, overstressed and feeling overwhelmed. And you can definitely see why Riri feels that way. So, all right, let's move on to the last book. It's Daredevil number 22. It's written by Charles Soule. We have art by Goran Suzuka, colors by Matt Miller, who we've mentioned before. And this is it part two? I think it's part two, right? I'm not seeing the name of the story. But basically, part two of the story that that Charles Soule started telling about the big plan, right? When we're talking at the end of the purple storyline about how Matt had a Supreme, that's what it's called, sorry, Supreme part two. So when Matt had this idea that could change crime and get rid of crime in New York forever, it's not quite that, I don't think that, I think that's overselling it, basically, I'll put it that way, to have this idea that Matt could come up with an idea that would rid crime forever, but he's got his identity back as Daredevil, and he's got a really ambitious plan on what to do. And we saw in Supreme part one where Luke Cage and Echo were able to stop this gang of crazy criminals that were planning on blowing up City Hall and out there firing guns off and everything. And Daredevil was a witness to it all, but he purposely did not actually take place in any of the fighting. He literally didn't lay a hand on any of these guys. And what that allows him to do is he can go to court and he can testify. And obviously there's all kinds of precedents and legal maneuverings to be done because the defense is going to challenge him. There have been cases in the past and times in the past where courts have allowed people to testify anonymously. And so there's the whole thing of the defense trying to say, well, how do we know that this guy is even Daredevil? And what I love about this is it's Charles Soule taking advantage of the fact that he's a lawyer in real life. He has a law degree. He has his own law practice. And he's using that expertise to bring the legal side of Daredevil, the Matt Murdock side, like front and center into the story that he's weaving with Daredevil. He's bringing those two sides together in a way that's never been done before. And it's so fascinating. And you know, all the legal stuff is accurate because it's written by a real lawyer who does his homework on stuff like this. Now, granted, Charles Soule is not a criminal attorney. He mainly focuses on immigration law and such, but you know, he knows other people. And I have talked to Charles about this. He's talked to other lawyers and people he knows, people he went to law school and with, people that are criminal attorneys, and even people that work in the New York City District Attorney's office. He talked to when he was writing Daredevil to get ideas for stories and to, you know, vet things out and say, hey, would this work this way and that way, whatever. So, you know, it's all accurate. Charles really, really did his homework, and it's fascinating. I am fascinated by the law. I at one time considered becoming a lawyer. Thank God I didn't, but anyway, so I just like that they did that, that Charles brought that to the table. So in this issue, basically last issue ended with Daredevil on the stand saying, you know, I'm about to basically testify against this guy that we just caught. And so this series starts off with the judge saying, okay, you know, I'm here and it's my call. And, you know, I have the power of the state of New York vested in me, and I believe in the court system. And I'm going to consider the question that's raised here. But all that being said is I'm not a big fan of stunts, and this feels a little bit like a stunt, like, you know, you're doing this for press. And the district attorney's office says, no, that's actually not the case at all. Daredevil's been fully briefed. He understands the stakes of everything that's going on, and he's ready to testify. And the judge is like, I'm not sure. that he does understand the enormity of the situation, because this would set legal precedent and there's a lot at stake here. So he says, "Mr. Devil, if you would please attend my words, I'd like to," and Daredevil interrupts him saying, "It's Daredevil, Your Honor." He says, "Pardon me? One word, Daredevil. Okay, noted. You know, for the record, refer to him as Daredevil." Like, "Okay, Daredevil, you've been called on to testify against this Simon Slagansky. He's been accused of, you know, various crimes, and you're here as Daredevil, not in your civilian persona. And that basically means you're going to be testifying anonymously. And the law has accepted in the past the necessity of people testifying confidentially. And the expansion of this is potentially legal, but you should know the defense may move to force you to reveal your identity. And if so, I, as the judge, would have to entertain that argument and decide if you know, I'm going to entertain that notion. And if they prove their case, if they, you know, prove their motion has merit, you may be asked to remove your mask right here in front of everybody." And Daredevil says, "Yes, Mr. Murdock laid all this out to me." And the judge says, "And knowing this, you choose to proceed." And in the meantime, as the judge is telling him this, you know, we're getting Matt's, you know, thoughts on this. He's saying that, yeah, the slug, as he calls himself, was part of this gang called the Clip, and they tried to blow up City Hall, and the rest of them escaped, but they were lucky enough that they got Slug. And if the judge lets him testify, he's going to be able to put Slug away and or maybe get him to turn on his crew. But it's so much bigger than that. He fully believes it's legal for him to testify as Daredevil. And if this succeeds, basically it's going to set a precedent that maybe any superhero can testify within their secret identity, Spider-Man, Blind Spot, you know, whoever. And that could change everything, because their powers allow them to gather evidence that other people can't, like cops, just, they can't go, it's too dangerous or whatever. And if the superheroes can present all their findings in court legally, then there's no more just tying up the bad guys and leaving them for the police and hoping the system can get a conviction. Because, you know, I mean, face it, Spider-Man catches a guy breaking into a liquor store or trying to hold up a liquor store, and he webs the guy up and leaves him hanging from a lamppost, and the police show up. I mean, do they even have a cause to arrest them? Because they didn't see anything. So it makes it, you know, it makes it nebulous legally, right? But if the heroes can be a part of the process from start to finish and say, you know, this guy was doing this and I caught him in the act doing this. And so, you know, I caught him, I stopped him, and I waited for the police to arrive. They arrested him. And now here we are in court, you know, whatever it is, 2 weeks later, a month later, and, you know, being able to testify under oath, tell the truth, this is what I saw him doing. Obviously, that's huge. And Matt says, "Yeah, it's all I've been thinking about since the moment I got my secret identity back." But the problem is, if he does this and he is compelled to reveal his secret identity, everything the Purple Children did for him is out the window, right? So when pressed to ask or to answer the question, is he willing to do this knowing it's worth knowing that it's a risk, Daredevil says, "Yes, it's worth it." And so then the judge says, "All right, go ahead, proceed with your witness." And so before the prosecutor can even get out one question to Daredevil, of course, the defending attorney stands up and says, "Your Honor, if you will, I'd like to move to compel the identity of the confidential informant. And the judge is like, "I told you." And Daredevil's like, "Oh, it's all right. Matt Murdock knows what he's doing." So this guy takes it up to the judge and, you know, "Hey, here's the brief." They give a copy to the prosecution as well. He's going to have to read it and go through it. And he says, "Okay, I guess I'll have to issue a continuance so everybody can read this and the prosecution can prepare a response to say," because basically what this brief says is, why should Daredevil have to reveal his identity? You know, all the legal precedent and cases that apply. And the DA say, "No, that won't be necessary." And the defending attorney's like, "Oh, you're withdrawing your witness already? Like, you're not going to have him testify? I expected somewhat of a fight." I say, "You want a fight? You got it." And they pull a response out. They have already prepared it. And the defense attorney's like, "What? You have a response already? You don't even know what case law I'm citing in my motion. You don't even know what I'm arguing." And they're like, "Well, let me guess. You're arguing U.S. versus Sanchez, and, you know, you know, they're bringing up all the arguments that, that Mr. Baden, the defense attorney, had had come up with. And he's like, wait, you got my motion ahead of time. You got yourself a mistrial. That's not legal. You can't find out what my work is ahead of time. And they're like, no, it's not that. It's that they knew if this guy was going to basically compel Daredevil to reveal his identity, this was going to be the cases he was going to cite. I mean, it's kind of obvious when you think about it. They knew he would do it. And so they were prepared. And so that's basically what they tell them. He's like, you expect me to believe that you and the assistant DA is like, no, not me. Get all the way to the end and read who signed it, who wrote the brief. And so he flips all the way to the end and he sees Matt Murdock's signature there. And, you know, Matt's got a pretty good reputation of being a legal genius. So that kind of shuts Mr. Baden up for a little while. And the other assistant district attorney says, yep, this is still Matt Murdock's case. We've been upfront about that. But because Matt Murdock has such a personal relationship and a longstanding friendship with the witness, we didn't bring him in to the courtroom today because we want this whole thing to be above board. We didn't want there to be, you know, any doubts or anything that looks suspicious. So we knew what arguments the prosecution or we knew what arguments the defense was going to have. And so we don't want to delay things. We don't want a continuance. We know everybody's time is valuable. So the judge says, okay, well, if there's no objections, let's take this into my chambers. You know, I can go over the brief and I can issue a ruling. And you can tell Baden's all upset. He's like, fine. So they march in there and Matt's still sitting in the witness stand, which actually wouldn't be the case. He actually would be not in the witness stand anymore because the court would technically be in recess. But anyway, for whatever reason, he's still sitting there and he's listening to them argue. And he's a little nervous. It's like, this is the part I really worry about. You know, the assistant district attorney is a great lawyer, but Baden is a serious lawyer too, you know, $1,500 an hour. And even though Porter, the assistant DA, is good on her feet, and I prepped her as much as I could, you can't anticipate everything Baden's going to say. You just can't think of everything. But it seems like things are kind of going their way. But Baden's getting his shots in there too. And all of a sudden, Matt's thinking, well, still, the judge probably won't. And then the judge says, that's actually a very interesting point, Mr. Baden. And Daredevil's thinking, oh, crap. Why did I do this? I just got my secret identity back. This isn't the same as some fight in an alley. I'm betting everything I am, my entire life, everything I've worked for, that this will work. And I'm not even the one that gets to argue it. My fate is in somebody else's hands. And if my identity gets out again, it's not like I'm going to have a second chance. I can't go round up the purple children and get them to put the genie back in the bottle again. So my life will be over again. And so he thinks, man, my tombstone could read, couldn't tell the difference between fearless and stupid. And he thinks, should I make a run for it so I don't have to unmask? And he's like, no, that's going to look bad. Plus, probably set Slug free right away. And then he hears the judge say, all right, I've made a decision. Let's head back out. And he's like, all right, it's too late. I've leapt. Let's see where I land. So the judge comes out and he basically says that the prosecution hasn't convinced him that a man who wears the suit is not anonymous. In fact, he's very well known, right? He is Daredevil. He's not actually testifying as somebody anonymous. He's testifying as Daredevil, somebody that they know his longstanding stance on crime. They know how many times he's helped the city and the world. And other courts have affirmed the idea that under certain circumstances, witnesses' true identity can stay confidential. You know, that's been in various courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Daredevil satisfies those conditions in the eyes of this judge, but only if the guy sitting in that witness stand is Daredevil. And Daredevil's like, did you miss the suit, Your Honor? And the judge says, well, anybody can put on a suit. And so that's where that must have been the good point that Baden made, right? And so even though the judge had said early on, look, you know, I didn't hope this wasn't a stunt, didn't want to see a stunt. He's like, okay, well, now I guess we'll be seeing some stunts after all. So he turns him over to Mr. Baden, and basically Daredevil has to prove he is who he says he is. And so Baden says, all right, you claim to be Daredevil, we see the red suit, but as the judge noted, anybody can put on a suit. So if you're Daredevil, prove it. And now this is a really hard thing to do. You know, how do you prove a negative? He says, all right, well, you know, start with super senses. And he says, there's a woman in the lobby out there on her phone, and this is what she's talking about. You know, go ahead and go out there and check. And Mr. Baden's like, she could be a plant. You anticipated what was going to be in my brief. You could have anticipated this line of questioning. So that's hardly proof. So he's like, okay, well, fine. You had spinach salad for lunch with strawberries, almonds, blue cheese, vinaigrette dressing, a Diet Coke. I can smell all that. Am I right? And Baden's kind of gets this look on his face, and Matt's thinking, I could also tell him that it's not agreeing with him. Like, his stomach sounds like a garbage disposal, but you know, I'll leave the guy with a little bit of dignity. And then he says, and you think you got me, right? You could just say you had a hamburger and that I'm wrong. So I must not be Daredevil. But ask yourself something, Mr. Baden. Are you sure there's nobody in this courtroom that can vouch for what you had for lunch today? And if you lie and they don't speak up, well, that would make them liars too. And I'm no expert, but it seems like it's a bad idea for lawyers to lie in court. And Baden, you know, thinks better of it and says, yeah, you know, I wouldn't dream of lying. And yeah, I had a spinach salad for lunch, but it was in a public restaurant not far from here. Again, real easy for you to have, you know, put people out, plants out there in order to find out what I had for lunch. So I know you're anticipating this line of questioning. And Daredevil's like, this is getting ridiculous. If I'm not Daredevil, then what am I doing here? Well, that Baden says, that's the question we're trying to answer. Now, please, I'm asking you to remain calm. Don't freak out. Daredevil's like, oh man, calm. I'm ice cold. And he's trying to convince the jury that I'm getting all wound up and I'm a hothead and I'm untrustworthy. He says, lawyers, they're just the worst. I tend to agree. Sometimes lawyers are the worst. Obviously Matt throws himself in there as well. And before Baden can ask another question though, the rest of the gang, the Clip gang, shows up, you know, Slug's partners, and they're ready to, there to free him basically. And they start attacking everybody. So Daredevil obviously yells for everybody to get down, and he takes out the Clip gang in pretty quick order. And during the ruckus, Slug even knocks out one of the bailiffs and grabs his gun, which I don't think bailiffs actually carry guns in court, but I could be wrong about that. May depend on the jurisdiction. But anyway, he literally points the gun at his lawyer. He goes, what are you doing? I'm on your side. I'm your lawyer. And Slug's like, yeah, my partners are here, so I don't really need you anymore. And you know what they say, the only good lawyer is a dead lawyer. And besides, you charge too much. But before Slug can pull the trigger, Daredevil takes him out by hitting him with the judge's mallet, and then orders eventually restored. So we don't get to see the end of the trial. We don't get to see the end of or the hearing of what happens next. But needless to say, it probably goes Daredevil's way, because on the next page, 2 weeks later, we're told, it seems that it all went to Matt's plan, because they're there in a conference room. They all have it looks to be like champagne and a cake on the table. All the assistant district attorneys are sitting there along with the DA, and Matt's thanking everybody in the room for their support. And they couldn't have gotten that good result without the hard work from, you know, every one of them. And it basically sets a real good precedent for what's happened and for the plan that Matt had for superheroes to be able to start to testify. So they all toast. And then the DA, Mr. Hochberg, asks Matt if he can speak to him out in the hall. And they go out there and he says, well, you know, you got a New York state judge to allow a superhero to offer testimony without removing his mask. That is well done. And Matt says, yeah, I can't believe things got as dangerous as they did, but you know, nobody was hurt. And now we've set precedent, which is huge in law, right? Once a judge sets precedent, then everybody can refer back to that. And, you know, you build up history of cases all based on that decision. Meanwhile, we see somebody else reading a paper, Daily Bugle, saying the devil you, and then in parentheses, don't know. And a superpowered vigilante Daredevil testifies in New York Supreme Court. So say, well, it's this kind of thing that sets precedent, and there's going to be a lot more cases, and there's going to be appeals, and there's going to be challenges, and it could go all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Matt says, yeah, I know, I'm ready. But we see the person that's reading this paper is the Kingpin. And he says, this is the sort of thing that's not fair. And you know what? I won't stand for it. So, I mean, Kingpin knows that if superheroes can testify against him. He's in deep shit for sure. So this is going to get him off the sidelines and gunning for Daredevil again in a hurry. So again, really great issue. And what I love about it, like I said before, it's how Charles Soule is using his legal expertise to tell a story that's both realistic with the law aspect, and that it marries the two halves of Daredevil together really, really well. So what are your thoughts on the issue, Jay?
Oh, I enjoyed it. It was really good. Because he was trying to figure out what the master plan was, and now it's finally going in motion, which is pretty cool. I like the question that they're trying to figure out, you know, is he really the Daredevil? And he gives them all these answers, but it's like, well, it's not really good enough until, you know, they break in. Then he's like, okay, now I can kind of show him who I am.
Yeah, they kind of played right into his hands by doing that. They would have been better off not showing up if they wanted to actually win the case on its merits.
Right. And then, of course, the Kingpin is like, of course, you got to figure out who's going to try to be like, I'm not going to go for this.
Yeah, I do find it interesting, though, because like I said at the beginning, when, you know, Matt had said, okay, I got a plan that's going to get rid of all crime in New York. I don't see how this gets rid of all crime. I mean, you think of him saying that, you think of like prevent the crime from happening. And I suppose it would lower the crime rate if people knew that superheroes could testify against them. But I mean, you kind of think, and I've always thought this about the Marvel Universe, if you live in New York with all the heroes that live there, all the Avengers and Daredevil and Spider-Man and, you know, Luke Cage and Iron Fist and just all of them, there's got to be something in you that wants to commit the crime anyway. Like if I lived in a place where all the superheroes live, like I wouldn't live in New York. I'd move. If I'm going to be a criminal and I'm going to break the law, I'm not going to live in the city that has the most superheroes. I'm going to go somewhere else where I'm less likely. So I kind of was thinking, well, how does superheroes testifying, like, it's not going to end crime. People are still going to commit crimes, but maybe it would reduce the crime rate. But then I thought, but would it really? I mean, the fact that there are all these superheroes that could, you know, catch these guys doesn't stop them from committing crimes. Is the fact that they can also testify against them now going to really stop them? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm kind of questioning that too. It's like, well, I guess it's a good plan, I guess. But I guess you get rid of all the kingpins, no pun intended. But I guess you get rid of all the main bosses out of the road, I guess, to get them out of the way. Because they're all super villains regardless, you know?
Yeah, it's true. But then there comes the whole thing about, you know, if you're part of the police or an established authority organization, you've got to have search warrants, you've got to have this, got to have that. Superheroes don't need that stuff. But who knows what the laws would be if we had superheroes in real life? Maybe they would need search warrants too, because, you know, the only reason we don't have laws on the books in real life is because those people don't really exist. So you kind of wonder, if you follow it to its logical conclusion, would it really work? You're still having to catch people in the act, you know, catch them red-handed, so to speak. And we know criminals like the Kingpin or, I can't really think of, like, maybe Norman Osborn would be another one that would come to mind. You know, they tend to try to insulate themselves. You know, Lex Luthor is a great example. Superman could never prove that he did anything wrong. He always had an excuse. Oh, that was a disgruntled employee, or that was this, or that was that. There was always several layers of protection between Luthor and whoever. And same thing with the Kingpin. So, and the fact that Matt's plan, by just what it is, by the fact that it's using the courts, it's going to be public. So we see right away, the Kingpin knows that it's a threat to him. And it's like, this is not going to stand. If it could have been something, or the plan was something that was more clandestine, then maybe you can spring it on the Kingpin when you have enough evidence to put him away for good, without him finding out. But now he knows. So now he's going to be even more careful and make sure to shield himself. So, but again, just the fact that there's all these different iterations and aspects to it, just shows what a great idea it is. And that's what I love about Charles Soule's run on Daredevil. Like, that's why I was so excited, because I knew Charles, and I know Charles, and I knew he was really excited to get on Daredevil and use some of his legal knowledge and stuff. And it's this kind of stuff. It's exactly this kind of stuff that had me so excited to see him on the book in the first place. So even though, you know, I'm nitpicking on the idea and thinking about, you know, how effective would it really be in reality? Right. I still love it. I still love this sort of legal maneuvering and the idea of it.
Yeah, it was just kind of nice that he put his knowledge in this story like that. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, all right, I guess that's going to do it for this episode of Marvel Monday. So, as always, Jay and I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.